Hi, y'all. Katie Parker, alcoholic. Yippee! We are so excited, so glad to be here. I got to tell you, Charlie and I love doing these Big Book weekends. And, you know, besides the people that we get to help, this is always a two-way street. You help us as much as we help you. And it's never that we come in, like Charlie was saying, and we're not coming in saying we're doing it right or anything like that. But we both have a tremendous amount of experience of having been in what we call... Okay, let's not be sure we don't miss that moment. Yeah, I know it is Dave Pistol. I get it. Is that we both sat in untreated alcoholism for many, many years in AA, and Mark used to say, how do you know what you don't know? We didn't know we did, and it's not even important. I don't know if a course of events that happened in my life would have woken me up. I was actually quite satisfied until I was awakened. And that's where it's troublesome. On page 14, it says, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot handle certain trials and low spots ahead. You see, I didn't realize that I was doing the AA meetings. I was doing a lot of service, but I was not working, continuing to work the disciplines of 10 and 11. And so what ended up happening to me is the certain trials and low spots, my husband got sick. And when he got sick and I got scared enough, I'll do just whatever it takes to get the job done. You know, we're going to make sure he's okay. We're going to do this and this and this. And I absolutely lost my mind in it. And in the process of losing my mind, unfortunately, my husband had 23 years sober. He did have a brain tumor that was benign, but we couldn't handle the pressure that we'd put ourselves under behind all of this, the financial situation. He went back out and relapsed and then died of a heroin overdose. It was tragic. It was terribly tragic. And here's what's really sad. You know, he had the health issues. He had all this. I didn't realize I'd hitched my wagon to this. So you almost lost me in the process. And that's what we don't see coming. See, now, I don't know if your trials and low spots are as losing a job or, heck, having a flat tire for some of us. You know what I mean? That can be just what sends us right over the edge. And what I didn't realize, and I wish I could have told you that I snapped right out of it and I came right around and went, wow, I'm not working an AA program. It didn't work like that. It was a slow, painful experience. It took me about 18 months to come out the other side of it. And one of the things that I can tell you is in those 18 months, I did some serious damage. I had already done a tremendous amount of damage when Joe was sick. And what I was hearing, and Charlie and I don't blame anybody for what we did. We did it as willing participants. There is no one in Alcoholics Anonymous to blame. There's no one in our families to blame. We took this on. We alcoholics are a tornado roaring through the lives of others without a drink in my hand. And so what ended up happening is even before Joe died, oh my gosh, the craziness, the self-will run riot that I went through. And I had a tremendous amount of friends of mine supporting me because my husband was sick. You know, we support people when they've lost someone, and I'm all fine with that the sorrow and the pain is definitely there. But we alcoholics don't get to stay in that very long. We really don't. We go from sorrow and the grief to self-pity, and we'll dig a hole and we'll live there. And it's a very difficult place. I never tell an alcoholic, we're not talking about you don't get to have your feelings. Oh my gosh, of course you get to have your feelings for about an hour. And then we're moving on, you know? That's about all you get. Because we will build a monument to these feelings. And then you'll get the world to support you. And then, boy, you are down a mudslide. So my job is to talk about the second step. And I got to tell you, I had some health issues in November, and it was, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, and please don't come up and talk to me about it. I'm so sick of talking about it. But I had November 6th, I had what's called transient global amnesia. I know, it's a big word, isn't it? Scared the crap out of Charlie. It scared the crap out of my son. I personally just came right out of it going, hey, hey, hey. Yeah. But it has had some lingering effects, and they were trying to tell me they found a little bleeding in my brain, and they said that your brain has been erased, and that's new information. And one of my strongest suits is I don't forget anything. Charlie can tell you that. I forget nothing. I mean, this is a data bank right here. And So I, unfortunately, am a little, every once in a while, a word is gone, and I love it. People always say, oh, that happens to me, too. It's like, no, no, it's different than that. It's not just your normal brain fog. This is definitely challenging. So if I get a little challenged, just hang in there with me. I'll pick right back up where I left off. We're going to talk about We Agnostics, page 44. And I'm going to tell you something. One of the most beautiful things about our literature, and my sobriety date's October 28th of 84. I am 33 years sober. Charlie is not. Okay? Just saying. And one of the things about that is it's so funny because we used to say he had a year less than me, and then he came at me one day and he goes, you know, I have 5.5 months less than you. And I thought, it's not a full year. And but I always tell him, you know, honey, when he's struggling at the house, I always tell him in about 5.5 months, it'll make more sense. Just hang in there, you know. So. I swear, we have so much brother-sister energy. It makes some people crazy. We love it. But when Charlie and I were best friends, we had no, there was just no sexual energy because I don't play that way. I was married to Joe. We were going to grow old together. You're my best friend. You're a boy. We're not going to talk dirty. We're not going to do that flirtatious stuff. I still don't play that way, period. And that was the coolest thing. And Charlie said he'd never had a girlfriend like that. Well, we became like brother and sister. And that is a little bit of a tough transition to turn into a marriage. You know, once you make out with your best friend, you're in big trouble. Don't think you can, you know, rewrite that script after that happens. You got trouble. And when Charlie and I went, and I made a move on Charlie, you know, he likes for me to say that to everybody. Because he was, yeah. So he was, we girls know we're running the show, okay? Hey.
She so, caught me at a weak moment.
Oh, sure. So, hey.
She so, caught me at a weak moment.
Oh, sure. So what ended up happening is when I made this move on him, I was absolutely in untreated alcoholism. He was in untreated alcoholism, and he holds his hands up and he goes, hey, you know, Katie, I'm not going to ruin a best, you know, 20-year friendship over a roll in the hay. Thank you, ladies. I was quite insulted. And so I thought, oh, you know, this is the player of AA. I thought, fine. And I just turned around to walk away. And I mean, that window was shut. And I get right to the door and he goes, hey, wait. Whoa. Yeah, you bet. Thank you. So he goes, wait, Katie, you know, so we come back to talk. And the next thing you know, I'm talking the moment that we think we can pull back from gets very heated. And I mean, he comes in way too hot and we bang teeth like 4 times, you know, and it's that moment where, you know, this is so wrong. We're in our 40s. This is so wrong. And then he goes to lay me down, and I've been a fitness professional all my life, so I'm pretty solid, you know, and he drops me about that far, you know, and knocks the wind out of me. And I know he's moving past it very quickly, but ladies, you know, we're in our head. This is wrong. What am I doing? And, well, needless to say, we got past that. Okay. So yeah, just saying. And so moving on. So now, one of the things, though, that cracks me up, we were laying in bed a couple of nights ago, and I don't know, I was reading my book and he was looking at the TV or his phone or something. And all of a sudden I said, hey, do you have my extra pillow? And his head was on it. And he has got a very large head, okay? And he just goes like this. And I mean, he put so much pressure on that pillow, just like your brother would. I mean, I said, hey, are you laying on my, do you have my pillow? And he just pressed his head down into the bed like,
hard.
You know, and I swear we laughed till we wet our pants. And I thought, that's that brother-sister stuff. Yeah. I could stab him with a fork and draw blood and enjoy it. I really could. Only like, you know how your brother could upset you and you could just scratch him till he bled? You just, yeah, come on, nod your head. You boys are like, oh, she's scaring me. Come on, think of your sister. Or you guys that were all raised by boys. Oh, my God, you just killed each other. You know, 4 boys in the family and you shooting BB guns at each other, you know? But that's what we got here. And as the weekend goes on, you're going to see it. Okay, so don't panic. It is just what it is, okay? We got a lot of energy coming at you. Dr. Silkworth wrote, I love this. The subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with an alcohol addiction. Isn't that awesome? I mean, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as Charlie and I said, we've been all the way around the barn. I've been on every side of AA you can be on. I've done many things wrong. You know, people are saying you can't do anything wrong. Yes, you can. I don't wish to shut the door on the past, but I can tell you I've done plenty of stuff wrong. And the truth of the matter is this big book still stays virtually untouched. I hope it stays that way. It is an absolute amazing piece of spiritual literature. It always gets me, kind of ruffles my feathers when people say, well, we only know a little. And they just want to pull one line out of the book just to diminish the entire book. And I'm like, you know what? Rest on that. You rest on that. I, on the other hand, am going to go deeper and deeper and deeper into this piece of spiritual literature. Because what it's done for me today, I can't even begin to tell you. The relationship I have with my Creator is like nothing I have ever had before. I've never felt so loved. I've never had such an intimate personal relationship with any human being, not even my children. For what I have with God today. And for that, I am so, so grateful. And I continue to work very hard at the disciplines to have this. So you don't get to have it, guys, just because you showed up here today. There is so much work you have to do in order to get this intimate personal relationship. So we're going to start breaking down we agnostics. And it starts on page 44. One of the things that I like to tell people is sometimes, like Charlie said, we go through the first step and we get you hopeless. The book says, move them through the work quickly, period. It says it everywhere. Action, action, more action, more action. It doesn't say sit and chill. And unfortunately, we have a tendency to do that in oral AA today. I'm not saying it's good, bad, right, wrong. I'm just saying it's the observations, right? And oral AA is really lovely, but I don't think they ever expected that you could go to 600 meetings a week. You know, in some towns, there's tons of meetings. And that we could actually stay sober on the fellowship. And that's what I did for a long, long time. I was one of the very fortunate ones that was able to do that. Not everybody is. I've seen people not be able to stay sober 48 hours on the fellowship. They don't even like us. You know what I mean? They're ready to go right away. And so one of the things that this is talking about is urgency. So we, once you do that first step experience, once you it takes about an hour to explain that hopeless state of mind and body, the allergy, the mental obsession. Then you ask them about their feeling, you know, how do you feel about the God deal? Just straight up. See, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is all experiential. See, I'm going to say, okay, is it possible that, so you got a problem with the God thing. Is it possible on your own power you cannot stay sober? Yes, good. That's all I need then. You know, I don't need much. I don't care what, I mean, we throw the gates so wide open. This God of your understanding is so broad. You can do whatever you want. Just so long as it's not you. Now let's move on to the third step. You with me on that? And the reason we do this is because that second step is experiential. Now you don't want to skip we agnostics the longer you're sober. It's one of the most profound pieces of literature you'll ever read. And I think it's designed to be studied, and deeply studied. And it says... we're talking about, now before I get into the whole telling you the pages, it's about bridging the gap, right? And understanding. I've had people come up at these workshops and I didn't know it either. Where is the first step in the big book? It's easier to read the 12 and 12 because the steps are numbered, right? And I discourage that. I don't say read the 12 and 12 if you want to, but that's not the book that is going to be taking us through the work. These are the clear-cut directions. This is the great. The 12 and 12 is a good piece of literature. Very good. But don't let it stand in the way of the great. So you just need to know where the first step is. It's the doctor's opinion to page 24, right? Is the allergy. And then from 24 to 44 is the mental obsession. And then Bill's story is the progression of alcoholism in the mix of all of that. So just so you know that the first step is the doctor's opinion to page 44. And it's so interesting the way the book flows, right? It talks about more about alcoholism. There is a solution. When they get into it, there is a solution. They start talking about more about a spiritual aspect, right? And then they go, hey, we're coming too heavy on this. Let's go into more about alcoholism and get into those mental blank spots and all of this. I think it's really important for us to understand that when the new guy comes into a meeting, we got to be very careful not to just share our drinking experience with him, because if we're not careful, he's going to look for the differences. Well, I didn't go to jail. Yeah, well, I didn't lose my family. See, we need to be talking about the hope, the allergy, the mental obsession, and the hope. The way the allergy showed up for me was. The way the mental obsession showed up for me was. It's not about getting scaring the new guy, right? And I think that that's really, really an important aspect to understand what that first step is about. I personally, when there's a new guy in the meeting, I personally would rather take him outside and do a first step outside than bring him back into the meeting and introduce him to the fellowship. Just my opinion. And I love on page 58, and this is something that's in How It Works, bottom of the page 58. It's How It Works, we like to say, is the most read, least listened to piece of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is. Anytime you redundantly read anything in AA, be very careful because you just zone out. But at the very bottom of the page, a couple of lines up, it says, some of us had tried to hold on to these old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. What are we talking about when we're talking about old ideas, right? Today's day and age, the terminology is belief system. I still like referring everything back to the 1935 terminology, old ideas, right? And one of the things is that what is an old idea? It's a prejudice. It's a prejudice against anything. Oh, my God. I'm not going to get off into this, but this year's political race destroyed us in AA. We stepped against the tradition completely. Put it on Facebook and everything. You broke a tradition. Serious, people. You don't get to do that. We don't get to do that. We don't get to talk about the women's movement. We don't get to talk about this stuff. This is what will separate us faster than anything in AA. We don't get to do that. We got old ideas just out the wazoo going on in this world. Politically correct, you name it, we got it. And we don't get to have that amongst our fellow AAs. I don't even care if you're like-minded. We don't get to have it. If you and I think the same way, we don't get to sit here and talk about it. It must stay out of this process. Mm-hmm. She's getting heavy, isn't she? I'm telling you guys, don't underestimate it. It will destroy us faster than anything. So page 44 to 57. The word agnostic means one who neither affirms or denies the existence of a personal deity. That's interesting, isn't it? And one of the things I can tell you is a lot of us will say, on page 44, it begins starting to say the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. This is where we're getting into this God of my understanding, right? We're getting into starting to open up that door, you know, the higher power, whatever you want to call it. But it's telling us right at this point, we hope we have explained to you up from doctor's opinion forward to page 44, the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Sometimes you'll hear us say things like, oh my gosh, I watched somebody leave a half a glass of wine. I don't understand how. We hope we've explained the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Now, I know we say that tongue in cheek, but it says in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. You need to know why they leave that there. They're probably a moderate drinker. They will never have what we have. And then you have to know the difference of the hard drinker, right? The hard drinker looks just like one of us sitting at the bar stool. But given sufficient reason, they can stop or moderate. See, it's that allergy that changes the dynamic of me. Just because somebody even got 3 DUIs does not make them alcoholic. It means they got really bad luck, I can tell you that. They need to be driving Uber, right? But that still doesn't make them alcoholic. Now, it does raise a question there, and I'm going to be asking them. But the truth of the matter is if they can't. And it also talks about in the first step is that it's important that I know if you're alcoholic. You know, we take lines out of the book, and it says that we're never allowed to tell anybody they're alcoholic. Oh, no. Read what that's saying. When you're sure the guy is alcoholic... See, there's a reason Bill and Bob wanted to be sure who they were working with. They needed to know because without that identification will not be there. And then it says, now listen to how they sum up doctor's opinion to page 44. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I mean, does that not make your butt pucker? I mean, think about that. When you're really in trouble. And then they do that. You go, oh, there it is. There it is. I knew it. I knew they. I already saw the steps on the wall. I knew it. They're going to bring that God thing in here. Knew it. There, here comes all my old ideas, all my prejudice. Typically comes from about an 8-year-old kid, especially any of us born in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, right? We were all going to church because we had to. Now parents aren't, you know, some are doing it, some aren't, whatever. But it's very non-existent a lot. I know we're somewhat, is Florida considered the South? Okay, Texas is not, so I get a little confused. I'm sorry. in the South, it's a little bit different. You know, you can a little bit more freely speak of God. But in other parts of the country, there's just not a whole lot of anything going on. And so I think that's very interesting. Remember, in step one, we're not trying to convince the guy he has a problem. We're trying to convince him he has no solution. He already knows he's in trouble. He knows, didn't all of us knew we were in trouble long before we just didn't know why. Same reason with Dr. Bob. He did not get it. So we've got to break that allergy and mental obsession down. Why would I be interested in the power if I thought on my own power I could do it? It's time after time after time I cannot do it. I set myself back up. Over on page 45, first paragraph. Says lack of power, that was our dilemma. Now, a dilemma means both sides of it suck. You do realize that, right? So that's why it's a dilemma, because, you know, it's like, you know, I can't imagine life with alcohol. I can't imagine life without alcohol. They both suck when I'm in them. And that's kind of one of the big problems. We'll get more into this in the third step. But this fear is not the root of my problems. I think that's real important to understand what fear is. Fear is the driving force. It's the old idea that drives me to do the crazy thing. Self-centered fear is what my problem is, right? I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I think I need, or when I get it, I'm going to lose it. I'm not going to get the job. Oh my God, I got the job. Now I'm going to lose it. I'm not going to get the boy. Oh my God, I got the boy. Now I'm going to lose it. I'm not going to get the house. Oh my God, I'm going to get the house. How am I going to pay for it? You see, it's this game of Pong, and I don't even know I'm playing it. And that's why it says we're driven by 100 forms of fear. It could have said 1,000 forms of fear, because they're ever changing. Depends on my viewpoint. Right? I'm scared. I'm not going to get it. Not going to get it. Not going to. Oh my God, I got it. I got it. I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose it. Lose it. And see, it's just a da-bong, 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 da-bong. And if we're not careful in life, we will try to manage our fear. And that's not what this is about. This is about complete defeat. Getting so connected to this relationship with this creator that if I lose the job, sure, is it going to scare me? You bet. We're not trying to say we're going to be never have feelings. But we're going to get to that place that we go, you know what? God's going to take care of me. I'm going to go take care of God's kids today. The only thing that works when I get that scared, break up or lose your job or money or your kids are making you crazy, go help a drunk. Go help a drunk. Only thing that ever works. So it says, obviously, but where and how are we to find this power? I mean, we come, you know, this last part of our lineage with Mark and the walk with Mark Houston. How many of you guys ever got an opportunity to meet Mark Houston? Oh, look at that. That just, I'm telling you, get a hold of some Mark CDs. He was amazing. He was an amazing teacher. He would make me want to be better. I like that. I hope I'm a teacher that makes you want to be better, but that's what Mark gave me. And I emulate what Mark gave me because I know I got enough of that in me, right, to help you. I still will always respect you, but I will also tell you the truth. And that's something that I think is really, really important. I'll do it as lovingly as I can, unless you're too hard-headed, and then I'll just hit you between the eyes. You know what I mean? I mean, that you invited that. Let's not forget. You know? Because that's what I always love. You know, some people go, gah. I'm like, oh, my God, you were not getting it at all. And, you know, after a while, you guys got to do kind of the Three Stooges. Tush, 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 you know? And then they go, okay, I got it. I got it now. I got it. But it says... So Mark used to turn statements into questions, right? Ask yourself these questions. Because you see, I don't know where you are in your AA program. And we love to be the man on page 73. We are the actor that has a certain reputation we know we don't deserve. You know what I mean? If you could have seen the way I treated my children this morning, or the person behind the counter at the 7-Eleven. You know what? I'm not that spiritual giant I proved to be. I'd rather you come tell me that. Makes me love you more when you tell me. I don't necessarily think you need to raise your hand in an open discussion meeting and share it, but You know, because you know what? We're gonna judge the crap out of you. You know, because that's just what we do. So you got to realize where and when that is to tell that stuff. But it needs to be told to somebody. You know, I'm not doing very well. And so it says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Now, I love the terminology they use. Its main object is, bye, honey. Its main object. Oh, yeah. And he's gone. Okay. In a little while, he'll sit over there and eat an apple. And its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which can solve your problem. Now, remember, your problem when you first come in is alcohol. It's a big problem. But we begin to understand quickly that alcohol is but a symptom. Setting aside the drink problem, I don't know where I missed that. I thought once the obsession to drink was lifted, I got it from here. I mean, when they're talking about selfishness and self-centeredness as the root of our trouble, I was voted most likable 4 years in a row in high school. That was not me, okay? Charlie, obviously, but not me. You know what I mean? And once I saw the level of self-centeredness in Charlie, I realized it wasn't me. I mean, I know I'm not alone in this, guys. If I can find one other person in AA that's more self-centered than I, they clearly are the extreme example, the one in the corner here. They clearly are the extreme example than I am, right? And I begin to think that I don't have it, but they clearly do. It's, hey, I'm telling you, your ego's trying to kill you on all levels. And so it says, and I love this, so then our problem becomes living. Right? And if we're not careful, between 18 months and 3 years is when I think you're in the most danger. So you guys listen closely if you're between 18 months and 3 years. What happens is you've been working a program based on the abstinence of alcohol. And all of a sudden you don't understand that your problems are this level of self-centeredness that are creeping up. And when you come into AA, you're taught integrity and dignity and respect. We teach you that. Everybody came back in the room. Everybody sits down. You try not to get up if you don't have to. You try not to start talking to people. You learn that you're not supposed to do these things. We teach people this, which is crucial. However, what ends up happening is you come in, you're the only one setting up the chairs for the meeting. Nobody else is. Right? You're the only one making the coffee because nobody else is. You're the guy who's helping everybody, and you look over, and Bill's hitting on the new chick. Uh-huh. I get it. And before you know it, man, you got to go. You got to go. You hate your home group. You grow to hate your home group. I think everybody in this room has gotten to that spot in AA, right? You may not want to admit it. You don't have to. I'm just saying that that's what it is. And so one of the things about that is between 18 months and 3 years, if you're not taking somebody to understand that this level of self-centeredness is going to kill you, you're going to leave AA. And if you do make it past the 3 years, because you're going to hit a wall at 3 years, and 7 years, at 12 years, you don't get to miss these. Pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth, period. We should embrace it. Page 133, the deliberate manufacture of misery. God didn't do it, but when trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it so he can show his omnipotence. So the next time you're running late to work and you go out to your car and it doesn't start, be happy. It ain't going to happen. See, it's going to take a minute for us to get to that spot where we take that deep breath and go, wow, God, this is really sucks. Whew, okay. Pull it back. See, that only comes by the disciplines. I may be able to pull it off two or three times, but by time number four, I'm gonna do it however I want to do it because of self-will. I'm doing it all based on self-will. And so these spots are your spiritual weight. If we believe pain is the touchstone of growth, why do we resist it when it comes? We should embrace it. Right in the fourth step, it says to get rid of this promptly and without regret. It's trying to tell us to not go to self-pity. And then it says in the fifth step, we will be delighted. We will know our Creator better. You see, it's a process of subtraction, guys. And we fight it like crazy. We want to coast all the time. And that's what we did in our drinking, right? I mean, we overshot the mark every time. It's almost like you'd look back at the mark going, whoa. there we go. I want to stay right here. No, 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 no. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, that one foot on the floor of the room is spinning. Bad problem. Especially if you're a woman. Bad problem. It's like you guys just go, she's spinning. Look at her. Go. Move in. Move in. Move, move. You know, and I always like to drink and be very much in control. You know what I mean? I know who's all around me. So then it says, about half our fellowship had a problem with God. Of course they did. And if you come to me and I'm sponsoring you and you got a problem with God, I'm going to give you about 10 minutes and then we're moving on. I'm not going to sit there in the whole, you've already built a monument to the God issue. Okay, well, then if you got a problem with God, let's go to higher power. I don't care. I don't care if it's the sky, the universe, the trees, Mother Nature, anything as long as it's not you. That's all I'm interested in. So then it says, and here, this is the question we like to ask. So when you guys came into AA, how many of you guys, by a show of hands, had a problem with God? Half our fellowship. Still the same. Still the same. It's unbelievable. Page 44.
How many didn't?
How many didn't? And then there's half that didn't play the game. So there you go. I don't know where you stood, but I'm not interested. Okay, page, it takes up too much time, and I'm moving on. Page 44, second paragraph. Now, here comes the real dilemma, right? Now, listen to this dilemma. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Okay, page 44, second paragraph, turn it quickly. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Now, I got to tell you, a dear friend of mine's daughter was in her 30s, and she'd, she needed to get sober. She's drinking a couple of fists of vodka a day, had two boys in school. And then the mother-in-law and the husband, they all sat down, because I'm a firm believer in the book where it says help the families, right? You got to help the families get to Al-Anon. I'm telling you guys, don't just tell them to go to Al-Anon. You have to tell them that they're trying to come, you know, stop a freight train with a butterfly net. They're not going to stop alcoholism. They got no idea, and we're going to chew them up and spit them out, and it is my responsibility to help them get to the fellowship that they need so badly. So I'm reading this line. And I said, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. And my buddy looks at me and goes, whoa, wait a minute. He goes, that's hard for y'all to see? I was like, yeah, I want to know a little bit more of the definition of doomed. I mean, is doom still going to have some fun in it? And, they both suck. Right? Or we got the idea. And then it says, do I believe this? Are these my two choices? And remember, all we have to offer is identification and power. That's why one drunk can help when no one else can. One drunk talking to another. It doesn't matter if you drank at home, if you drank in the bars, if you had 5 DWIs. It doesn't matter if you were raped. That's the problem. We want to get people thinking they got to identify with the circumstance. That's not true, guys. We've just got to identify with the hopelessness. Wherever it took you down the road, it took you down the road. And I can help you in a lot of areas. But I think we kind of get off into lawyers need to work with lawyers and doctors with doctors. And, you know, now I am a fan of women with women and men with men, and I'm leaving it at that. But I'll move on. Staying sober is the, and I don't think that's black and white, don't get me wrong, but I think majority should be cautious of that. Staying sober is the bare minimum, right? We got to have you sober. But that is the bare minimum. It's not the finish line. Now, we're going to go, the book talks about in We Agnostics prejudice 6 times. What is prejudice? Yes, it's prejudgment, but it's the old ideas that are judging me. See, I don't even know I have old ideas. I have old ideas on women are, men are, children should, the millennials are. Ugh. I've brought another piece of inventory on them. I'm telling you, wow. If I get a sponsee that's living on the government dime, I have been working since I was 13. He said 15, 13. I've been working since I was 13. I left home at 15, 28, just saying, a little bit of problem in our marriage. And And so I got these old ideas, right? I got a lot of old ideas, you know, with the children. Shoo them out of the nest. I'm not the mother that's going to miss the empty nest. I can't wait for it. I'll push out at 17 if I can. You know what I mean? It's like flap your wings on the way down. But that's the kind I am, you know? I was a working mom. I'm also, I believe in spanking children. Oh, my God. I could just go, you know, go down the road. And so the world and its people really dominate me based on these old ideas. And so it's important that I know my old ideas. Now, I don't want to get married to my old ideas, but I do need to know them because they're going to come up in my inventory over and over and over. And if I believe lack of power is my dilemma, the only way I can get through these old ideas is with the power. And I got to know that even though I remember doing some inventory work with Lorenz, and I, oh my gosh, I just love Lorenz. Marty Ruby's my sponsor, but Mike Lorenz does some amazing 10 steps with me. And I know Mike Elf. Okay, you know, whatever. This is, because this is being taped, it should stay right here. Are you with me on that? But one of the things that I love is that when I was talking to him one time, I'm the sheriff of the world. I really am. I mean, I know you think you are, but when you're in my presence, you're merely a deputy and I'm running the show. And, you know, I'll put you in office at some point, but I'm still doing the deal. And one of the things that I told Lorenz, I said, Mike, but if I don't stop this, look what'll happen. And he goes, oh, Katie, he goes, that's the problem. See, you believe, if not you, who? And what'll happen is you got plenty of people behind you that are willing to take your position. Just doesn't have to be you today. See, I didn't know that. I didn't think there's anybody behind me. I thought it was just me. And then when he told me, he says, he goes, first of all, I'll never forget when he asked me, he goes, what would happen if you took the high road? I remember thinking, well, I never have. I have zero experience in taking the high road. I don't even know how to get there. Okay? So I don't know what that means. And I found that a lot of you don't. Okay? There was only a smattering of chuckles, but I think more of you don't know. And so one of the things was is that I said, so what is taking the high road? And he goes, just matter of fact, tell the person, hey, you know what? That's fine. Go ahead and do that. And just step back. Or say, you know, look, I'm really sorry. I had no business saying anything. And step back. Oh, and so, well, I started trying it. And then, of course, all, you know, that stuff runs downhill. My sponsees then had to get it, too. And they didn't dig it much either. But what we realized is the view on the high road was beautiful. And not only that, then about 3 years later, he said, Katie, on this one, you're going to have to take the high road. Oh, okay. Now you're really bringing too much to me. I said, so you're telling me there's a road higher than the high road? And he said, yes. He goes, you have deep spiritual pockets. Take the high road on this one. It's even prettier up there. I had no idea. I had no idea. Now that doesn't mean I just get it out of my mind and I'm feeling less or anything. That means I'm taking this in my evening review and my morning meditation. I'm looking at those corrective measures. Because that's what I must do, guys. I'm a tough little broad, okay? And you scare me bad enough, I take a step forward. And that is not always good. You know, I can go to FU instantly. Yeah, and this is Charlie has witnessed it more times than not. Now, in our relationship, I don't because he doesn't play that way. And that took a while. But I can tell you, I can. And it's the worst way to start a conversation. Just terrible. Terrible. It doesn't go well at all. And then you think you've set the ground rules. And what you've done is you've embarrassed yourself and you've put the other person so deeply on the defense and you can't work your way back out of it. And I love it. But sponsors go, well, that's what I've always said. Oh, well, I know that. That's what we're working with right now. How's it working for you? So it says here, when we're talking prejudiced without examination, right? We have to write inventory. And Charlie and I'm a huge fan of writing a ton of inventory. Some people disagree with that. And I say, well, have you done it? Because if you haven't done it, I don't want to hear an opinion on experience you hadn't had. Take the next month and write the crap out of inventory. Be sure somebody hears it. Don't just write it and not have anybody hear it. But write the crap out of inventory. Tell me what your experience was. If you didn't like it, fine. Then we have something to talk about. But I'm a huge fan of writing inventory. I bet Marty and I do a 4-column resentment inventory at least once a month, if not twice a month. Then in my evening review, I write inventory pretty quickly. It takes me 6 to 8 minutes to write a piece of inventory. So I'm just saying, have an open mind. If you absolutely shut your mind to this, observe that. Okay? And just keep an open mind to what we're saying. Give it a whirl. Hey, man, if it doesn't work for you, fine. Then you got an experience. Now you can start talking about it. Page 49, second paragraph, says, we beg you to lay aside prejudice. Beg you. Isn't that interesting, the terminology they use? They're really begging us to please look at this. How do you know what your prejudices are if you're not writing inventory? I mean, that's where it shows up, even against organized religion. So it's just, yeah, organized religion, we got problems there, but this is even against organized religion. And I'll tell you, my mom died when I was 8. It was so sad. She had a kidney disease, but back then it was in the 60s. It was 67. And, you know, there weren't grief groups. Your kids couldn't even go to the hospital. And so when they took us in the hospital, you could sense something was really wrong. And she died basically the next, you know, that night. And the next morning, my dad comes in, tells us all your moms, you know, died last night. And I'm 8. My sister's 9. My brother's 12. And my dad's a traveling salesman. He was an NFL football player, but he's a traveling salesman for Union Carbide. He's an electrical engineer, some type of engineer in that terrible at 60 years old. I still don't know what engineer he was. But and so when we had the funeral, we had people telling us God needed your mother. Now, don't get me wrong. They meant well. I mean, this is 1967. What are you going to say to a grieving kid? The only thing to say is, I'm so sorry. And I'm here if you need me. Watch the stupid things people say on death. Oh, my God. I always said after Joe died, I'm going to write a book that says what to say to somebody that's grieving. And that is, I love you. I'm sorry. That's the book. Ain't nothing else. You know what I mean? Nothing else. Don't compare it to your feelings. Don't identify with your feelings. It's not necessary. I'm not even there yet. And so that was what they were doing. And then I was raised Catholic, and my mom was a Protestant. I didn't know until my 40s. I told somebody one time, I said, you know, my mom was Protestant. I have never seen a Protestant church. I've seen Methodist, Episcopalian. I've seen everything, but I have not seen Protestant. Yeah, I think that's pretty telling. I don't need to go any deeper. And so... So I'm raised, you know, Catholic until I'm, you know, 9, and we're excommunicated from the church. Now, I had a guy in a workshop come to me and goes, well, you weren't excommunicated. Your father was, because he remarried so many times. And I looked at him and I go, dude, he had the driver's license. I mean, what, do you think I'm going to pedal my bike to, you know, a Catholic church where they're speaking in Latin? I got no interest. The sooner the better for me. But I had these old ideas. I always believed in God. But I just figured he wasn't interested in me. That was my whole deal. Today, I have the most incredible loving relationship, and I really attribute so much of that to Mark Houston. Mark Houston made me want to be a more disciplined individual on 10 and 11. And if you want a deeper relationship with God, you can go to church. You can go sit at the ashram. I'm certainly not saying that's not something that can fulfill your deeper relationship with the Creator. However, if you are blocked, you become the jerk from church and from the ashram. You see, this is all about getting unblocked. This discipline is about taking everything to God, practicing forgiveness. Oh my gosh, is that difficult. Practicing our amends process, going back and asking. I'd much rather ask for forgiveness than have to forgive. I can tell you, I don't forgive well. I mean, I keep score, take notes, laugh when you fall, you know. You name it, I do it. I'm not a forgiving person, and it is really a lot of work. It does not come naturally, so don't think it's a natural thing and other people have it. It's a lot of work. So then it says, we're going to talk about this self-reliance, God-reliance. You see, I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as a woman who has got so much self-will. I mean, wowza. I got a lot of it. I left home at 15. I finished high school. I cheated my way through. I was a successful businesswoman. And I got a level of self-will that would make your toenails curl. I'm not kidding. I mean, it even surprises me. And so you want me to set this tool down for your hinky little God tool? I'm just not going to do it. I mean, I can get way more accomplished than God could, because I'm that type of girl. Now, Charlie's self-will didn't work well for him. He said he constantly would, you know, hit the wall, hit the wall, hit the wall. I could convince a blind man to get glasses. I mean, I was that kind of girl. You got my mom, my daughter used to say, Mom, if you get in your vortex, watch out. It's like, whoa. You know, and I could, Charlie will say what I'll do is I'll, you know, I don't even know where I'm going, but I'm at the head of the pack and everybody's following me. And he goes, he'll go, Katie, where are you going? I'm like, I don't know. And he goes, well, you got 15 people behind you. I'm like, I know. But I don't know where I'm going. But I like being at the head of the pack, you know. And I mean, it's really interesting. And the thing about this whole relationship with the Creator that we're trying to form is this still quiet voice that everyone in this room has heard. We heard it drunk and we heard it sober. You see, God loved us no matter what and still does. We don't have to do good to get God's will. God doesn't test us. It's not of that nature, right? This still quiet voice when you were drinking was don't go. Don't go down that alley. Don't leave her. Stay. And when we're in sobriety, we're just trying to get that still quiet voice more often and louder. And it will be louder. Now, it does also sound like the ego. Sometimes you got to be very, very careful, right? The ego always goes, oh, you don't need to do that. And then the next thing it says is, why did you do that? Why'd you do that? You know? And I mean, it'll just make you crazy. And then it goes into the steps, right? So we're going to talk about 4 through 9. The purpose of 4 through 9 is to get me unblocked from the sunlight of the spirit. You can call it whatever you want. I mean, every religion, the ashram, the Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, everything, they've got a name for the sunlight of the spirit. We call it the sunlight of the spirit because it's broad. We're not going to call it anything but that. You can call it whatever you want as long as that's just between you and you. You know, we don't need to be doing that to our sponsees. We've got to be very, very careful that everybody's got their own spiritual journey. And I don't want to do anything that's going to distract from that. And so 4 through 9 is about getting us unblocked. Now, on page 55, in the second paragraph, it says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. See, we're fooling ourselves. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another, it's there. You see, that's the good heart of people. That's the sincerity. That's where we're later going to talk about a mere code of morals or better philosophy. We're insufficient, period. That's drunk or sober. See, don't think you can't lie, cheat, steal, have an affair, all kinds of things sober. You absolutely can. The drink's coming. These are things that we can do sober. See, I thought you could only do them drinking. Nobody told me that. I just assumed it. Then 10 and 11 are for the disciplines to keep me unblocked, right? If I am not doing the disciplines, and remember, 10th step is a spot check inventory taken throughout the day. We have somehow muddied the waters in AA to where the 10th step is the evening review. It is not the evening review. The 11th step is the evening review. The 10th step is a spot check inventory. So imagine that you're not going through the day watching for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear. And when these crop up, asking God at once to remove them. Immediately call somebody. Quickly make an amends and resolutely turn our thoughts. See, the 10th step has become a damage control step. And what you're missing is the purpose of watching. That's the spiritual trick behind all this, is watch yourself. Heck, watch yourself in here. There could be things about my personality that you took an instant dislike to. There's people I take an instant dislike, don't even know you. You just walked in the room and went, don't like them at all. Don't even know them. That's just everything about them. Can I tell them about the guy with the knives in his pocket at the grocery store? Okay, we do a lot of shotgun shooting, we love it, and our coach, of course, they're not, you know, alcoholic or anything, and so every once in a while when he's with us, we're quite the show, right, and we're standing there, and Charlie, the guy in front of us, first of all, we like to claim him in the line at the store as, what was it, the dad, what did we call him?
Super dad,
yeah, he's super dad, because he's in front of everybody, so he's going to be super dad with the kid, going to play with them. You're right. Going to play with the balloon. Look around. Super dad. Yeah. You know. And so he's super dad, you know. And at one point you want to go, dude, Just move forward in the line, okay? No more high fives, no more popping the balloon, just move. And so, because, you know, Charlie always likes to say, we judge no man. That's all we do is judge. Okay, am I in the right group of people? We just judge, and they turn around and look at you and you go. And so then the guy's got, like, everything but a Romco fishing thing on his hip. I mean, he's got 19 knives on one side, and he's got this on the other side, and Charlie is fascinated.
Okay, I lean over to our coach, and I go, okay, Trevor, God knows I judge no man, but I want you to look at this guy. I said, he's got a knife in his pocket. He's got a knife next to that one. He's got a knife next to that one. So there's three knives in this pocket. Right? Okay, I can get past that. He turns the other way. He's got three knives in this pocket. And then that thing on his belt, I think it's a Ronco pocket fisherman, but I don't know what that is, you know. And so we're checking him out. At one point, he goes to stick his hands in his pocket. He goes, oh, you can't do that. I got seven knives on me, you know.
Oh, and it was so funny. And then when he's walking from the bathroom, I stopped him. I go, my husband is fascinated with what that thing is on your hip. And he pulled it out, and it was another knife. It was not a Romco fishing thing. But he seemed like kind of a normal guy at that moment. But Charlie said, no, nobody's normal with that much on their hip. So, but it was so funny to watch our shooting coach do one of these. I always tell you, go through life and watch how many people do this to you. Just that little move speaks volumes. We always think it's just because we're so honest. It's like, no, I don't think that's it. Think you may have overshared. I'll give you that. And then the 12th step says that we continue to practice and carry this message, right? And once again, you know, Charlie's saying, and once again, you know, we're just giving our observations. Don't think you're doing it wrong. I hate that. I hate that approach because I love AA. And if I did anything wrong, it was truly out of love, and I apologize if I did. But as Charlie was saying, the first step is misunderstood. You did the first step just getting here. Some people say the first three steps just getting here. The 10th step has now become the evening review, and the 12th step has become optional. So in 80 years, we're going to implode. You know, if this illness is hereditary and my grandchildren have it, I'd like for them to come and have this, you know, the steps still intact as to what they mean. And I think that's why it's important. I don't want to come out here and say, we're doing it right, you're doing it wrong. I think that's a terrible approach. I think the truth of the matter is to look at the facts, consider them, and ask yourself what that means to you. And so then it says, the only problem with all of this, and I'm going to go bear with me about another 10, 15 minutes, and if you have to get up and go to the bathroom, it doesn't bother me. Here's the problem. We fall asleep in sobriety. You cannot not fall asleep in sobriety, period. You know, you don't even know you've fallen asleep. You remember when you were in school and they'd tell you that there's a film, you're going to be watching a film? Well, you couldn't just lay your head down, you know? You had to do this. And that's a miserable feeling. Right there, oh, that's terrible. Getting into it was great. You know, and that's, you know, when we're doing these workshops, I love to find the guy who's falling asleep and trying not to. This one with his big old melon head, oh, my God. We were on the front row one time. Show him how you did it, honey. Oh, come on.
Well, it looked like I was on methadone. I'm sitting there. And, you know, and it had gotten to where it was already like, where are you going? I mean, the chin goes all the way to the chest.
Oh, my God. At one point, I just, like, watched. I thought, I'm with him. That's it. I love him. I love him to death. And it would roll to the right and pop back. And then it would roll to the left and pop back. I was like, oh. And remember, it was with Chris. Chris was speaking. Oh, my gosh. But we're so tired. You know, sometimes you're tired, and I get it. I get it. But we fall asleep in life, right? And so on page 55, the second paragraph is going to tell you about the bedevilments. And the bedevilments, the term for the bedevilments, we use a 1935 Webster's Dictionary. And I love it because the words back then meant something different sometimes. It means unrelenting torture. That's what the bedevilments are. And I'm telling you, I know everybody in this room has been in these bedevilments at some point in your life. You don't get...
Did you say 55? It's 52.
Oh, I'm sorry, 52. 52. Sorry. 52. Middle of the second paragraph. And it says these bedevilments. Now, ask yourself, these are real guidelines. Now, you may have a couple of troubles with them now, but you're not living in them. There's a big difference between living in them and having trouble with them, and that's what you need to know. And is everybody on the bedevilments? Did I get everybody got it? It says we were having trouble with personal relationships. Ask yourself that question. Having problem with mom, dad, the kids, people at work, significant other. We couldn't control our emotional nature. How about that one? I mean, everybody's bothering us. I'm upset everywhere I'm at. We were prey to misery and depression. Now, depression, I'm not going to be in here saying you should or shouldn't take pills or anything, what depression is. Are we over-medicated? Yes, I will say that. No doubt about it. I sponsor enough people to say that. Who needs it and who doesn't? I don't know. I got an opinion, but I don't know. But the truth is I think what we have to be careful of is depression can be self-pity. And if you go to a psychiatrist and you lay out these bedevilments, they're going to give you medication. We can't blame the healthcare profession on giving you medication. You asked for it. You know, and I was somebody who did. I took medication for 6 months. I think it saved my life, if you want to know the truth. Thank God I didn't stay on it for a lifetime because I'm not a depressed individual. But I was so deeply in self-pity. I couldn't and it wasn't even Joe's death. It was before Joe died. I mean, trying to live with somebody with brain damage and, you know, the type of personality I am, it was hard to keep my ducks in a row. Says we couldn't make a living. Most people hang their hat on the fact that they can make money. But are you enjoying life with what you got? That's what it's asking you. We had a feeling of uselessness. Oh, that's a real easy one to come by. We were full of fear. And remember, the new term for fear is anxiety. Oh, I was in a meeting where the topic was anxiety. Yeah, that's the same way I felt. And you know what was sad? And this is what I fell prey to myself. Once again, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying my observation. What I realized is when everybody in the room talks about anxiety, I feel better. I go, wow, I'm not alone. Everybody. So what I'm getting is I'm getting relief, but I'm not getting the freedom. See, if you're feeling anxiety, write a fear inventory. You know, we got to get down to the bottom of this. You won't get well. And unfortunately, we surrendered the right to Klonopin and Xanax. You know, that made your butt pucker there, didn't it? You just went, you look down. I don't want anybody knowing that one. You know, and I get it. So it says, we were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people, you know, because we're so self-centered. We have gotten so, everything filters through me. When the book says the world and its people really dominate us, and we'll get to where that is and everything, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, have the power to kill. See, that's the problem is I don't realize that I don't think too much of myself or too little of myself. All I think about is me. Everything filters through me from the weather to the people in this room. How about is you got anybody next to you clicking their pen? I mean, to me, it's like I'm going to stab you with that pen if you keep clicking. If Charlie and I, if somebody's chewing gum next to him, someone's going to get killed. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? He sticks a piece of cotton in his ear, a thing hanging out. I'm like, oh, honey. You know, poppity snap, poppity snap. And to me, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, when we're watching this, the people really can make us absolutely crazy. They have no idea. I've made it so much about me. And this untreated alcoholism, one of the things I can tell you is when my husband died, everything was so challenging. And it wasn't even Joe's death. Joe's death was just the cherry on the top. It was like, really? Really? Oh, my God. We've 6 years up to this. It was so dark. And Charlie was my best friend. I was calling him, 5 times a day, you know, and he's talking to me and all this stuff. And he's an untreated alcoholism. I'm an untreated alcoholism. But I love the fellowship. I mean, that's always there. The depth of that was so important. But what happened is I had those four horsemen, with me in the bedroom. And we were living in an apartment. I was selling the house, and my kids are 10 years apart. One was gone. And my son and I were trying to make this happen. And, you know, I could just really care less, honestly, as being a mother. I was so done with everything. I was done with nurturing. I didn't want to walk the dog. I didn't realize that when I moved into an apartment, you got to walk a dog. Didn't see that coming. Yeah, that one just damn near threw me over the edge. And I'm, because that means you got to get home, you know, and this is before this whole dog walking app came out. And, you know, I mean, I'm losing it. I am losing it, thinking, my God, I got to get home. I felt like I had another kid in school. And so all of this is happening. And what would happen is Sam was 15, and he would open my door in my bedroom, and I would lay down any chance I got because it was so dark. And I said to him, he would open the door, and I would just scream, Sam, shut the door. Leave me alone. And this is a young man who had already lost his father, and his mother is losing it. I got no concerns for that. Just shut the door. I'm screaming it at him. Now think about what that's doing. Well, how that's down. There's no drink in my hand. There hasn't been booze. I'm 17 years sober. I am losing my mind. I had a road rage event that was we were in gridlock traffic. I got out of the car. I know it was a one moment the guy did. He nudged his way in front of me when he shouldn't have. It was my turn, and it was gridlock. And what he did is when he did it, he did that little chuckle, and he leaned to the side. And that's when you heard it snap. And I get out of the car, guys. Okay, think about this. Do you see there? You know, Pete, there was no stopping me. I was driven at this point. I get out of the car, and I do my hands like this, and I smash the side of his, you know, door, and called him a very ugly whatever. And he looks at me, and he goes, you know, and it was like life went in slow motion. He had his seatbelt on. He didn't put his car in park, so it rolled and hit the car in front of him, which I thought was so funny. And now this is all in slow motion, and he unhooks, and he gets out, and he comes out swinging. I mean, this is ugly. I have just put a big dent in the side of his door, and he comes out swinging, and I'm backing up. I got my glasses on. I'm backing up, and he catches my shoulder. Well, this is in Texas. You know, I think the same thing would happen in the South, but we're in gridlock traffic. And before you know it, two men were out of their car, and one of them had a billy club, of course. You know, who travels without that? And he has the guy, and he's got him around the neck, right? And he's holding him. Well, I misread that. I think it's my opportunity to come back and yell at him again. Yeah, so I come marching over there, and I go, let me tell you, you know, and right, and the guy goes, get out of here, you know, the guy holding him, get out of here. I thought, oh, sorry, misread that. You know, so I grab my glasses, I get back in my car, and it was like cars were parting for an ambulance. I mean, everybody just, right? And I go through there, and I go to where I'm going, and what I didn't understand and what I didn't see happening, I was so, when I came out of that blackout, I went, oh my God, what just happened? What just happened? Then I went into complete PTSD that I was seeing the guy everywhere. I mean, seeing him everywhere. I'd see his car everywhere. I'd miss that intersection. I mean, I was, you know, I was freaking out. And I got to tell you something. It was that moment in time where you stand back and you go, what's happening to me? I don't know that's untreated alcoholism. I don't know that. See, I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I sponsor 6 people. I don't see this as untreated alcoholism. I'm not working the steps. I'm not doing anything to treat my alcoholism. Meetings and fellowship don't treat it. They're an important part of that triangle. That unity and service are important. But the only thing that treats it is the steps. Okay? Just bear with me. We're going a few more minutes. And so those were my two horrific experiences that when I came out of untreated alcoholism, I saw those two obvious ones. And then, oh, God is so wonderful. He just opened this door on all of them. Thank God. Thank God I made more amends in untreated alcoholism than I ever made drinking. I mean, just consider that one. You ask God to show you all the people you've hurt, all the people you've disrespected, all the people that just won't talk to you anymore. It's a lot of them. And so it says on page 44 in the fourth paragraph. Everybody there? Says, if a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. You see, living outside of these values and sobriety is what this is about. You see, I mean, to me, it's like a sponsee that comes to you and they're living outside of your values. It doesn't, that doesn't matter. It's when I live outside of my values that I'm starting to have trouble. I slapped both my children in sobriety. I slapped one of them when they were 12, and that, like I said, they're 10 years apart, and I slapped the other when they were 15. And I was shocked. I'd never been slapped in my life. Now, I'm a spanker, but I was never slapped, and I slapped both my kids once in the face. Could not believe it. That's untreated alcoholism for me. Charlie and I did something that we're not proud of, but I'm going to say it anyway. I thought you'd reconsider. We did.
These are your facilitators.
Well, I believe strongly in transparency. I believe that that's the guideline to God being able to shine through us. You know what I mean? And don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, these are things that have happened over a course of time. I am not road raging. I'm not slapping my children. I mean, this is what I'm talking about untreated alcoholism is. When Joe died, it looked like I wasn't going to get the life insurance policy. He and I had both agreed that we were going to get him a very expensive life insurance policy, and it looked like we weren't going to get it. Wow. Because it said on there, have you ever had drug and alcohol treatment in the last 10 years? Well, he was 23 years sober, and that was not the case. And so we checked off no. And so when this all came about, they said he died within a two-year period of getting this life insurance, which is a probate period. Doesn't matter if he'd have been in a car accident. They're going to investigate it, right, to be sure that it's a legitimate case. And they called me, and they said he had gone to an addictionology doctor. I didn't even know what that was at the time. And we're looking into that. It does look like he's had some drug and alcohol treatment in the last couple of years. And I am livid. I am crazy. I am laying in bed sweating in the middle of the night that this is terrible. I'm not going to get this life insurance policy. I need this money. I mean, I am a single mom. I got a kid in college. Are you with me? I mean, this is scary stuff. And so when we realize that it's all resting on this addictionology doctor, and in AA, you begin to understand who these doctors are and who, blah, blah, blah. And so, Charlie and I both talked quietly, and we agreed that we'd go talk to this doctor, but we were going to have a little bit of cash in our top pocket.
A fat envelope, as we call it.
Yeah. Now, we're not proud of this. This was, what, 15 years ago. But we are both in untreated alcoholism, and I'm capable of a bribe. That money was mine. I deserve that money. So if you got to bribe him, Charlie, I'll just sit there and smile. and we're cut from the same cloth here. You know what I mean? One of us wasn't going to go, that is so spiritually wrong. You know? And thank God when we met with this doctor, he said, so they only need 97? And I said, yes, sir, they do. He goes, they don't need 96? I said, no, sir, they don't. I'd prefer they not even know about 96. And he said, well, then they won't. And I got the check, and we didn't have to give him the bribe. But I am here to tell you guys that that's what I'm capable of. Untreated alcoholism, it's not about booze. It's about alcoholism and what it does to me. It's the most dangerous thing in the world. And then we're going to talk when we come back, maybe. We got another hour to go. It's how you feel. We'll probably have another 20-minute break, but we're going to talk about logic. So 20 minutes. Thanks, guys.